Welcome to the second day of our Jacksonville sitting, and today we're, Judge Grant and I are very glad to be joined by our friend and colleague, Judge Hull. We had Judge Dubina with us yesterday. Judge Dubina will be back tomorrow, and then Judge Hull will finish out the week on Friday. You're familiar with our lighting system, so when the yellow light goes on, that means your time is drawing to a close, so please try to finish up. If we take you beyond the red light, then don't worry about it. You're on our time and not yours. And with that, we're ready to begin with our first case, number 16-11062, Stephen McLeod versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. Mr. Woodley, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. I'm John Woodley with the Bedell Firm. I represent the appellant, Stephen McLeod. Before I dive in, I wanted to note that there are a couple of rulings below that are discussed in the briefs that it appears this court may lack jurisdiction to review. There was a report and recommendation entered by the magistrate judge recommending the dismissal of Mr. McLeod's claims against certain defendants, and an order entered by the magistrate judge denying Mr. McLeod's motion to appoint counsel. Neither of those was reviewed or ruled upon by the district judge, and my understanding is that normally this court doesn't have jurisdiction to directly review a decision of the magistrate judge, so those issues may not be properly before the court, and so I intend to focus my energies on other issues, the issue of the revocation of Mr. McLeod's informa pauperis status and the denial of Mr. McLeod's motion for preliminary injunctive relief. The revocation issue comes down to whether an indigent prisoner with a claim based on a chronic disease has to wait until that disease damages his liver before he can turn to the courts for relief. The complaint in this case presented allegations signed under penalty of perjury pointing to two potential dangers. One was a substantial risk of infection with hepatitis C and other bloodborne diseases as a result of the inmate barber program that didn't provide for adequate sanitization of the equipment in a way to have that program proceed in a safe manner. The other was the danger from a lack of treatment for Mr. McLeod's hepatitis C, which this court has previously recognized as a serious medical need, which means, among other things, a medical need that, if left unattended, poses a substantial risk of serious harm. And this court recognized that in the Brown versus Johnson case. In revoking Mr. McLeod's informa pauperis status, the district court ignored the first danger and it rejected the second danger of the lack of treatment for Mr. McLeod's hepatitis C based on self-serving opinions offered by one of the defendants, Dr. Verona, in a declaration.
What procedure followed when the defendant submitted their information to the district court? What was the sequence of events, and when did the district court rule after those submissions were received? Do you remember?
So initially, Mr. McLeod filed this complaint and submitted his application to proceed in forma pauperis. The magistrate judge then issued a report and recommendation recommending that leave to proceed in forma pauperis be denied under the three strikes rule.
Right, the district court initially set that aside.
That's right.
And found that Mr. McLeod had set out imminent danger under the statute and granted him IFP status, but then revoked that after the defendant submitted information. And my question was, what was the period of time, if you recall, between the defendant's submission of information and the time the district court ruled the second time?
I am not sure of the time period offhand.
That's okay. The specific time period is, I mean, doesn't matter whether it's 2 days or 3 days. I was going to use that to set up a second question, which was whether Mr. McLeod was given an opportunity or had an opportunity to contest the submissions put forth by the defendants.
Yes, Your Honor. After
I have the dates here. The motion to revoke was July 2015. Motion to revoke with Dr. Verona's affidavit. And then the R&R by the district court happened. I mean, R&R by the magistrate judge. And there were objections to the R&R. And then the district court revoked it on, it looks like, in 2016. Does that sound about right, about 6 months later?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Maybe it was sooner than that. Excuse me.
I think
September 18, 2015.
That's correct. I think it was the motion for reconsideration that was denied in January of 2016.
Okay. Then there was a motion for reconsideration. Yep. Did the defendant file, the plaintiff file something in opposition to the motion to revoke?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. After the motion to revoke was filed, the magistrate judge issued an order saying, since the motion to revoke refers to materials outside the pleadings, I'm construing this as a motion for summary judgment, and he directed Mr. McLeod to file any opposing materials within 30 days. And Mr. McLeod then filed what he called a motion for summary judgment, and he attached an affidavit making a few points. One, that he had certain risk factors that were associated with a more rapid progression of hepatitis C, including his age and sex and his history of alcohol abuse, and pointing to the guidelines of the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases that were relied on by the Bureau of Prisons recommendations that Dr. Verona's affidavit relied on, and pointing out that those guidelines of the AALSD recommend that any prisoner be treated, or any person with hepatitis C be treated, and it also goes on to say that it's a good idea to do it early to prevent future liver problems. The magistrate judge struck that motion. I think whether it was correct to strike the motion for summary judgment or not, I think the affidavit at the very least should have been considered in opposition to the motion to revoke. So I think construed liberally, it's apparent that Mr. McLeod.
The fact of the matter is, in the end, all the district court did was dismiss the complaint without prejudice and has never ruled on the merits, would that be, of the case. Would that be a fair reading of where we are now?
I would agree with that, Your
Honor. Okay, so the case has been dismissed without prejudice. Unfortunately, Judge Hinkle didn't put it in his order, but if you go look at the judgment, you see in the final judgment entered by the clerk's office, it does say without prejudice. So the case is dismissed without prejudice. Subsequently, your client pays the fee, right?
That's correct.
And as a matter of fact, IFP, and I'm saying this so counsel for the defendant can get prepared on this, IFP just gives you a period of time to pay the fee.
Right.
So he's paid the fee. Okay. And there's never been a ruling on the merits of the case. We've just got a ruling on the imminent danger part, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So why would it not be satisfactory relief for you, assuming there's a way to do this? We just reinstate your case, filing fee's been paid, then y'all have discovery to the extent you do it and try to tee up the summary judgment issue. I know they're going to object to that, but you could go file another lawsuit. This is not going away. Your client has a life sentence, as I saw it.
That's correct.
Okay. This isn't going away. This is going to be litigated some way. We only got a dismissal with prejudice. He's paid the fee. It's kind of messed up procedurally, but why can't we straighten it out like that? And so would that not be enough? You've paid the fee. Do you really care about getting the fee? Well, you got to pay it anyway.
Your Honor,
so we vacate the dismissal without prejudice, reinstate the complaint, And I'll get to the merits.
Your Honor, I would be happy with reinstating the case. There is one additional thing I would want to raise. The magistrate judge also entered an order striking Mr. McLeod's motion for preliminary injunctive relief. He called it striking, in effect, it's the same as denying it. And under 28 U.S.C. 636.
Well, I don't even know about all that. Just give you 30 days to amend whatever the current complaint is. Due to the passage of time, this is like 2 years now. He's two more years with Hep C. I don't know what his condition is. He's getting no treatment. I've read up on this on the internet. You know, I'm not sure that's really good, but I did because I didn't know anything about it. And they advertised, take this for Hep C on the nightly news. So I don't know. I can't figure it out whether you really need to have treatment now or you don't really need to have treatment now. There seem to be pros and cons, different opinions. I have no idea. So somebody needs to get some experts and y'all decide this. It just seems like that's where it should go, if we can do it.
That is, in general, satisfactory.
You
that
should
is
say yes. That sounds
want.
Wonderful.
That's what I meant to say, Your Honor. Yes, that sounds wonderful.
And I have to hear from the defendant why procedurally we can't do that. But it's just going to all end up. He's paid the fee now. He even paid the appellate fees up here. Or you paid them.
That's correct.
Somebody paid them. The Bedell firm probably paid him.
It was not the Bedell firm, but I believe he did pay.
In other words, the question is, why isn't the appeal moot in the circumstances we have present, given that he has paid the filing fee for the institution of a second suit making the same allegations, given that suit number one was dismissed without prejudice?
Okay, I missed. Is there a second suit?
There is not. It has not been refiled.
Didn't he pay the filing fee for suit number two so that he's paid two filing fees now?
He has not filed the second suit and paid the filing fee for that.
He paid the filing fee for the first suit.
Yes, Your Honor. It was taken out of his prison account after his informal pauper status was revoked.
Then, if that's the case, why was the case dismissed without prejudice?
Because it didn't all happen until after it was dismissed without prejudice.
Right, so I'm saying, so if the case was properly dismissed without prejudice, right, then taking out the entire filing fee post-dismissal might not have been quite right.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And also, I would, you know, urge that the imminent danger determination was error, and that the dismissal should be reversed. But Your Honor certainly makes a good point about the taking the filing fee out of Mr. McLeod's after taking the filing fee out of Mr. McLeod's account after dismissing the case.
Right. If to go back to Judge Hull's attempt to solve this procedural puzzle, if it can be done, I'm not saying it can, but I'm hypothesizing, direct that filing fee, which was taken out post-dismissal, be used for any reinstated complaint that he files, that lets him litigate the claim anew, doesn't it?
It may. There's sort of a distinction, I guess, between reinstating this action and allowing him to file a new one that may be important. There could potentially be statute of limitations issues.
Which one do you want? You want to reinstate this one or file a new one? I don't know whether we can do either one, but which one do you want?
Well, I would love to have this one reinstated, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Woodley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've saved your time for rebuttal. Toomey, good morning.
I'll address your concerns directly. As far as the response to the initial motions, Mr. McLeod filed his response after the court
magistrate judge issued the report and recommendation, okay?
He filed them as objections to the R&R.
Well, it's not especially clear to me. I know that it was after.
Okay.
I know for certain that Judge Hinkle read them all. That's the way Judge Hinkle is. He's a very inquisitive judge. He read this record. There's no question about it. As far as reinstating or refiling, it's a question I wasn't really prepared for. I've done a lot of this work. It is always required to be refiled. I can't tell you today why. It's just something I didn't consider. It is always required to be refiled, not reinstated, when an order rejecting IFP has been made. Maybe subject to additional briefing, or we find another way around it.
Let's talk about the imminent danger then. He's not being provided any treatment right now?
Now, that's not information that I have direct access to. My clients are no.
Well, I should not have phrased it that way. I'm sorry. At the time matters were litigated in the district court, he was not being provided any treatment?
That's not true.
What did the affidavits that your client submitted say about his treatment or lack thereof?
There is a brief history that I can go into here to set up your answer. 2013, at the end, Harvoni comes out, cures hepatitis C. No one was prepared for it. End of 2014, Sovaldi comes out. It's $85,000 for each drug. There was no funding for it. Insurance companies weren't paying for it. DOC didn't go to the legislature and get the money. Then, by the way, there's, in that prison system, 25 to 30,000 people with hepatitis C. Not all of them need to be treated with Harvoni or Sovaldi. There's a criteria that's.
I thought there was an Ibuprofen or something like that. Now that's cheap.
Later drugs have become
cheaper.
That's
really cheap right now. And y'all say he's being treated because he is getting blood tests. He's seen. Your definition of treatment is he's being seen with the test. He's being monitored, et cetera. But he's getting no medicine. He's being monitored. That's the form of the treatment. Is that not correct? That's what Dr. Verona says.
We're stuck between times here. In 2015, yes, he was being monitored because there was a criteria for people that needed the treatment.
We're not questioning your motives. We're just asking you, what is the treatment he's getting?
At the time, the treatment was to monitor until he met the criteria for the drug.
Okay.
And he never did.
Okay. And the criteria for the drug, as I understand your expert, and what's written about this, is you got to be suffering liver disease. You got to be in show some type of cirrhosis or some type of liver function impact, I guess would be a way to say it.
By blood testing, liver enzymes,
right,
and ultrasounds. Now, times have changed. I can't tell you that he's not getting treated because there's an injunction in place out of the Northern District requiring the DOC to treat. Last year, they treated 5,000 with the drugs. I think Judge Walker says next year it's got to be 7,000. I don't know if he's in there. I know that that's the Hoffer case. I know that Mr. McLeod has filed documents in there trying to intervene. I can't tell you whether or not he's been treated, but Judge Walker treated that.
Is Judge Walker's injunction against the entire DOC?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so is it a class action?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I missed that. Maybe y'all know.
No, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I missed that totally.
But his notice of appeal was 2 weeks ago.
I mean, I heard about it in the news, but I haven't read any of the underlying materials. But it's being done, as you say, it's being done in stages.
Correct. There's a lot of moving parts because it's a ton of money. It's more than $100 million next year. But Judge Walker's figured out a program. There's a plan of testing, there's a criteria, an order of treatment. Everybody's getting treated. That's part of the injunction. Whether Mr. McLeod has been treated.
When you say treated, you mean monitored and enzyme testing to get to the point of where they need to take a pill or whatever
correct
the treatment is.
But it's a different criteria. It evolves over time. When these drugs come out, typically, and especially for these drugs, there was no data that the Gilead, the pharmaceutical company, had to tell the practitioners who needs the drug, because not all of them need it.
Well, we don't have a merits question here, do we?
At the moment, no, except for the injunction. The injunction's already in place. The injunction in this case is moot.
There's no injunction in this case.
No, it was denied. It's been briefed.
Right, but there was no injunction in this case.
Entered, no.
Right.
No, sir. There is an injunction in place, though.
Right, in another case.
Right.
Has the Department of Corrections challenged that injunction, the Judge Walker injunction?
The notice of appeal came out 2 weeks ago.
So the answer is yes.
Yes, ma'am.
You filed a notice of appeal.
I did not. My client was not involved in that litigation. It was...
Who? Your client, the DOC, is not involved in the litigation?
DOC is not my client. DOC was dismissed before we entered.
Who is your client?
Horizon, Pliskin, and Verona. Pliskin's a nurse practitioner, Verona's a physician.
Okay. Is the DOC the client in the injunction case?
Not my client, but they're involved. DOC and the current medical provider, which is Centurion of Florida. They are not my client either.
I'm having trouble straightening out this case, much less getting to the other one. So can I go back to this case?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The filing fee was paid after it was dismissed. We understand that.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so what precludes us as a matter of law? What rule or something you can cite me that says I can't vacate and reinstate this case under all the facts and circumstances now that he's paid the fee? Yes, it's too late, but... Why couldn't this panel do that and then we just start over?
Like I said, it wasn't a question I really considered, so I didn't brief it. All I can tell you is, in the districts,
I mean, that moots the imminent danger. He's paid the fee, right?
I agree.
Imminent
danger isn't an issue if there's a fee paid.
And I'm not even so much interested in whether the barber clipper just calls the Hep C or not. He's got Hep C. However he got it, he's got it.
Yes, ma'am.
And the prison population has got it like 60-70% more than the general population for whatever reason. And some people say it's because they don't treat people initially, so it's spread or whatever. I don't know what the answer to all that is either. So if we wanted to do as little as possible, so just to unwind this kind of procedural, we could just vacate, reinstate, the filing fee applies to this lawsuit, and then give them 30 days to amend, and everybody can try to figure out where this is.
I cannot tell you that you cannot do that.
Cannot, thank you.
Because if that filing fee had been taken out before the judgment of dismissal came in, the lawsuit would have proceeded.
Correct.
On its merit.
Well,
right?
Again,
All that the lack of imminent danger does is deny IFP status and require the prisoner to pay the filing fee. And if the filing fee after Judge Hinkle's revocation had been taken out of his account immediately, then the lawsuit would have proceeded without IFP status, right?
Probably not. It probably would have to be refiled. He would have required it. And I think just standing here in puzzle work.
Why is that the case? Why should that be the case?
Well,
in other words, if the purpose of the statute is to prevent frivolous lawsuits, right, and to deny the privilege of IFP status to prisoners who fall under the three-strike system, if nothing's been taken out of the prisoner's account and IFP status is later revoked, why can't the filing fee be paid then to satisfy the purpose of the statute?
I think it's because the statute requires dismissal. And once it's dismissed, the districts or courts are going to require refiling the case. Now, can you say otherwise? That's why you get those chairs. Of course, I think you can.
But I thought he also moved for reconsideration of the dismissal. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Do you know?
No.
Remember that? No, he didn't. Okay.
It's not anything I have. I did not litigate this case.
Well, all right. So if he paid the filing fee before the order was entered dismissing the case, then it wouldn't have been dismissed.
Likely.
Okay.
If he would have sent an agreement to pay it, you know, over time, it's $1.20 or something, whatever he's got in there a month. No, it wouldn't have been dismissed before the order was entered. If he had changed his status before the order, then the case would have continued. But I think because the statute requires dismissal, it requires refiling.
Medically, then, if we have to reach the imminent danger issue, I hope we don't, but if we do, tell me medically why Judge Hinkle correctly revoked IFP status based on the submission of Dr. Verona.
Sure. The question that's hanging over it is, why would Judge Hinkle even consider doing it if it's been initially reviewed? And why is it that we always review them when they're filed, and now sometimes we review them after a lawyer shows up with more information? Well, it's because it's the nature of that statute. As lawyers, we're required to make sure your record's right. The statute is for frivolous claims, and if I can tell you, whether there's a lawyer in a case or not, every one of these cases, the 800 or so that I've had, has the same custom argument. You did it to save money. And every time, barring one that I can remember, it turns out to be untrue. Anybody can plead anything. So that's why we go back and do it.
I don't get me wrong. I don't object to being able to review the IFP designation at a later time when more information becomes available. I'm asking you on the merits of the revocation. Why did Judge Hinkle get it right? Why, given the information you submitted, why was there no imminent danger to Mr. McLeod?
Because he was not in his hepatitis C condition, was not in a position where it presented imminent danger. He was being monitored for that to happen.
What is your client's or the DOC's definition of when that happens?
Well, it was done according to, at the time, Bureau of Prison Standards, because they were the only ones that had any, and so they adopted them. And so there was liver function tests done on a regular schedule, ultrasounds done on a regular schedule, and I can tell you that Judge Walker's order isn't much different than that. That's what they're still doing. They're doing it in a little different way, but those are the two things that tell you how the disease progresses. The disease doesn't affect everybody. 60% or so of people never know they have it. They never have anything happen.
They don't know they have it till they have a liver problem. What the doctor says is, according to Mr. McLeod, his laboratory results, including an ultrasound, testing of liver enzymes, and platelet counts, all reflect within normal limits. And that's why Judge Hinkle then said.
Correct.
Everything's still within normal limits, so he's not yet got a liver impact, is how I read it. And so he dismissed it. Said
that is
not
correct.
Imminent right now.
That is correct. As long as there is no effect from the disease doesn't get treated. But the treatment, that doesn't mean there's no, and I'm using treatment the wrong way. There's no drugs, unless they need them.
Is that a uniform medical opinion?
It is.
There's nobody out there who thinks differently than.
Internet thinks differently. They say you should start right away because and never get to maybe the drug company.
The internet doesn't lie.
But these medical. Internet.
There will be physicians that say everybody should be treated.
There's a CDC website that has a subset of this that strongly recommends. It's been debated. I have no idea. I'm not saying I believe all that. I'm just saying you go to the CDC.
There's always going to be a physician, Judge Jordan.
Uh-huh.
But it is within the medical community, this is how they're going about doing it, how to figure out who gets the drugs, not just in prisons. The same criteria.
You know, I think after a while you learn to be skeptical of some arguments made by both sides in litigation. And so here, as you said, a number of the complaints that your client sees have the same sort of cookie cutter allegations. I would venture to say that if that's the case, then your responses to them might be
cake cutter, in the sense that you say, no problem, no harm, no foul. And if the district court is relying on interested parties to provide information with regards to a potentially disputed medical matter, I mean, did Dr. Verona say, listen, there are people who disagree with me, and that some people think that there should be treatment from the very beginning, even if there aren't symptoms or whatever, but my professional reasoned opinion is different, and you should follow mine instead of the others. If you want to look at something else, take a look at the Centers for Disease Control, take a look at this, take a look at that. No, it was an interested affidavit, and I don't mean interested in a bad way, but from a party's representative. And so how's a district court supposed to figure all of that out when it doesn't have all the medical information that it might need?
But at the same time, we asked the court to do a preliminary review on the same information, but it's only from the plaintiff. How do they do it?
No, I know. That's why I don't have any issue with the district court revisiting the matter later on when new information becomes available. I don't have any issue with that.
It's still going to be a contest. I don't have an answer for a better system. It's still going to be a contest. There's going to be interested parties saying interesting things to each other. I don't have an answer.
Okay.
I have one question. There's also this motion that if we don't reinstate the complaint, he wants requiring the district court to reimburse the filing fee, i.e., if we affirm the dismissal and say you got to go file a new complaint. Was there an opposition you filed to the motion to reimburse the plaintiff his filing fee? Did you oppose that motion? I don't know whether we have that motion
I think it is up here.
It is up here. Okay.
My gut feeling is that it is up here. But
I certainly wouldn't oppose such a thing.
Okay, Mr. Zumi, thank you so much.
If I can make just a couple of points. Judge Hull, you mentioned that the internet says you should go ahead and treat people with hepatitis C, but it's not just the internet. There's some of that in the record, too. Mr. McLeod's affidavit that I mentioned and that he filed when I was up here before that I mentioned, it attaches some material from the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, which is the same organization that the Bureau of Prisons recommendations rely on. That says everybody with hepatitis C ought to be treated, and it even says it's a good idea to go ahead and treat early in the progression of the disease so you avoid further liver problems. There was also a question about the timeliness of Mr. McLeod's response. There was a document that he titled response to the motion for revocation. That may not have been, I'm not sure when that was filed, but the affidavit I was referring to was filed in a timely manner. The magistrate judge issued his order requiring summary judgment opposition materials within 30 days. And Mr. McLeod filed that within 30 days. Finally, I think the reason that Judge Hinkle may have felt compelled to dismiss the case was a decision of this court called Dupree versus Palmer that the magistrate judge cited in his report and recommendation. So if that's correct, that dismissal was appropriate, assuming that he didn't show an imminent danger, then I think there's still an error in the finding of no imminent danger. It was early in the progression of Mr. McLeod's hepatitis C as far as their record reflects. But I think the Sixth Circuit in the Van Diver versus Prison Health Services case that's been cited in the briefs has the right way of looking at it. And they say that you don't have to wait until a chronic disease deteriorates so badly that the next instance of maltreatment is going to cause really serious harm. That ignores the progressive nature of the disease and has the potential to cause a lot of harm. And I would submit that the Sixth Circuit's perspective has a lot of wisdom, and I would ask that the court consider that.
One question on Dupree. This case seemed to me to be a little bit different in that, and I may need to read Dupree in full, but the court in Dupree originally denied the IFP and dismissed it, and then the party came in and paid it. Whereas here, it was granted IFP.
Correct.
And then revoked, and then the party paid it. I don't know if that matters as to the right procedure. Do you know what the facts were in Dupree? Was Dupree like this, where it was originally granted, and it may not matter, then revoked?
I believe Dupree...
I thought it was a denial from the...
I think Dupree was a denial from the outset. I'm not 100%
right.
sure about that, but I don't think Dupree was like this case in which it was originally granted and then revoked several months later after more information came in. So I think that may be potentially an important difference.
And is your client's... I missed your client's affidavit. I don't have that. But you're saying he filed an affidavit in as part of the objections to the R&R? I mean... After the magistrate ruled, is that what you're saying? I need to find that.
So, I guess two-part answer. One, he filed it as an attachment to a document he called a motion for summary judgment on count two.
Okay.
And that he filed before the R&R came out on the motion to revoke. Then after the R&R came out, he filed a document directed to the district judge saying, please consider my previous motion for summary judgment as objections to the R&R recommending denial of...
Thank you.
Mr. Woodley, I think you were court appointed for Mr. McLeod, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
We want to thank you very much for your service to him and to the court. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you too, Mr. Toomey.